This is Ozarks at Large for May 23rd, 2012. I'm Kyle Kellums.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
Support for KUAF comes from Circle of Life Hospice, focused on providing compassionate end-of-life care and bereavement support. Services are available in Madison, Carroll, Benton, and Washington counties. Circle of Life Hospice. Ask for us by name. More information is available at nwacircleoflife.org.
Later on this edition of Ozarks, getting outside. We'll find out why you may be seeing more ticks this May than usual. And eight gardens in and around Fayetteville are prepared for the 7th annual OmniPeace Garden Tour this weekend.
Our history doctor is also back with a look at the sometimes contentious relationship between the United States Supreme Court, the White House, and Congress. A discussion about why the checks and balances sometimes chafe is ahead.
First, about one-fifth of Arkansas's registered voters cast ballots during the May primary. The Arkansas Secretary of State's office says turnout for the election was just over 21%. In Washington County, voters decidedly turned back a quarter-cent sales tax intended to fund an expansion of public transit. The proposal was rejected by 64% of those casting ballots. Just over 13,000 people voted against the measure, while just under 7,400 voted in favor.
An expanded 4th Congressional District will have a new representative to send to Washington, D.C. to replace retiring Mike Ross. Last night, Arkansas Republican primary voters nominated Tom Cotton, a political newcomer, over two other Republican candidates. His Democratic opponent in the November general election, yet to be decided, State Senator Gene Jeffress earned just fewer than 40% of the vote, and Q. Bynum Hurst received about 35%. They'll face each other in a runoff battle in 3 weeks.
The only statewide vote other than the pretty much determined presidential nominations was for a seat on the Arkansas State Supreme Court. Court of Appeals Judge Joe Hart defeated Raymond Abramson in that race.
As far as the selection of presidential nominees, Arkansas's GOP voters gave Mitt Romney 68% of their vote, and Democrats gave President Barack Obama 58%. Democratic voters gave a lawyer from Tennessee, John Wolf, 41% yesterday. Jay Barth, a political scientist at Hendricks College, says the results highlight some of the differences between districts in Arkansas.
It's really no new news in terms of Arkansas's conservative Arkansans, especially white rural Arkansans, dislike of the president. I saw that the president did very well in Pulaski County, for instance, which is a place where, you've got more progressive voters and much more loyal Democratic voters who are turning out to vote.
Jay Barth says there is little doubt that Arkansas will vote strongly in favor of the presumptive GOP nominee Mitt Romney in the fall.
The University of Arkansas women's golf team is tied for 20th at the NCAA National Championship Tournament after the first day of play in Franklin, Tennessee. The Razorbacks continue play there today.
And the University of Arkansas Razorback baseball team is trying to avoid a quick exit from the SEC tournament in Hoover, Alabama today. Yesterday, Arkansas dropped a 9-1 decision to Mississippi State in the first round. They're playing Mississippi at this hour in an elimination game. Last chance I got to peek before we started putting together the show. The score was Mississippi 1, Arkansas nothing in the bottom of the fifth. This is Ozarks at Large, and the primary election results are in. And after a long night watching the results come in, Michael Tilley, the editor of thecitywire.com, is with me from Fort Smith on the phone. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. I just hope the general election doesn't go this long. I hope Secretary of State Mark Martin does a better job on the general than he did on the primary.
Well, we do know the results now, and it would show, a cursory glance would seem to indicate that more conservative Republican voters seem to be out in greater numbers.
Right. Especially in these legislative races. I think we saw some surprises where some of the candidates who did their best to out-conservative the other Republican candidate ended up winning. You have Woods beating Pritchard, you had Hester in over Summers, down in Fort Smith area. Altus once again comes in with a win. How he continues to keep winning is, I think, somewhere when someone finds a Bermuda Triangle, there'll be some book on how Altus is also winning these elections.
Well, can we take anything from these election results and apply it toward November?
Well, that I don't know. I don't think so. One thing I was surprised about was the relatively low voter turnout, and I think we may see that again in November. I mean, yes, there's a presidential race on the top of the ticket, but in Arkansas, that's really not President Obama is just, as the polls have shown, he just doesn't stir the voters here. So I think we're going to continue to see that low voter turnout. The congressional races, the 4th District will have a race, but there's no attorney general's race, there's no governor's race, the 2 U.S. Senate, there are no Senate races. So if we take anything, I think it's that if you want to win in November, if you can get the vote out, if you can get your folks to get out and vote and really have that good grassroots campaign, your chances of winning are better.
You mentioned the 4th District. Tom Cotton won the Republican primary. The Democrats will have a runoff on June 3rd. Is there any reason to believe, whether it's either of the Democrats who win and facing Tom Cotton in November, that the Democrats can hang on to the 4th District?
I haven't talked to a political pundit who thinks the Democrats are going to win that. I've talked to a lot of Democratic-leaning political pundits. I mean, the conventional wisdom was that whoever won the Republican primary there in the 4th was going to walk away with the office, which is a significant thing. It'll be the first time that Arkansas, I mean, if all the other districts remain Republican, it'll be the first time that they've all been Republican. So it'll be Senator Mark Pryor would be the only Democratic member of Arkansas's congressional delegation. The surprise for me in the night was that Cotton won that without a runoff. I knew he was gaining momentum. And, you know, Roby Brock conducted a poll about a week before that showed Cotton with an 18% lead over Beth Ann Rankin. And I think Roby took a little bit of grief on that. Folks were saying there's no way the race is much closer than that. Your polls is wrong. Well, I think Brock was vindicated. Tom Cotton, I think last I checked, won by about 20 percentage points. So to me, that was the surprise of the night.
And finally, I might be connecting dots here that I might be stretching a bit, but the transit, the quarter-cent sales tax to expand public transit in Washington County failed, and by a large margin, just over 13,000 to about a little over 7,000, 64% to 36%. Most people I've talked to think that if the highway sales tax is going to pass in November, it's got to have strong support in Northwest Arkansas. Does this show that highway tax a few months from now might be in trouble?
Well, yes, I think all taxes are going to be in trouble. You know, we saw the Siloam Springs, they wanted to raise a quarter-cent sales tax to fund the broadband, and folks there overwhelmingly rejected that. And I was also surprised by that transit tax. I thought it was going to be a much closer vote. But here's the thing. I think a factor in that transit tax is also, I think a lot of people would have supported that, but they wanted to see more of a regional plan, a regional approach. You know, Benton County Quorum Court said, nah, we're not going to do this. And so you had essentially the Washington County voters potentially subsidizing the whole thing. And again, I think a lot of folks who voted for that probably voted for it not because they're against public transportation or necessarily against the tax. They just didn't think it was a good plan, or maybe send in signals, say, look, guys, come back with a different plan and present it to us.
All right. Well, Michael Tilley is the editor of thecitywire.com. Get some rest, and we'll talk to you soon.
All right. Thanks, Kyle.
Thanks, Michael.
Northwest Arkansas continues to grow. That's no secret. Figures released by the U.S. Census Bureau last week show Benton County remains the fastest growing county in the state, and Washington County is the 4th fastest. One plan for possible future growth in the region is being constructed by the Northwest Arkansas Council. Recently, Roby Brock of TalkBusiness.net talked with Mike Harvey, the chief operating officer of the group. But before we hear from that conversation, Roby says a letter he recently discovered puts into perspective the change of fortunes for Northwest Arkansas over the past half century.
It is from then-Governor Orville Faubus to Mrs. Charlotte Schecksnyder, the longtime publisher of the newspaper, the Dumas Clarion, and one of the most powerful legislators at the state capitol before term limits. In the letter, Faubus responds to Schecksnyder's plea for the governor to help with funding on an economic development program in her southeast Arkansas Delta House district. Mind you, this was less than 50 years ago when this letter was written. Here's what Faubus wrote in his response. Quote, "The mountain areas of Arkansas generally are much poorer than the Delta region. That is only natural because of the rich soil and fine crops in the Delta, whereas in the mountains the land is so poor and rough that farming is very minor compared to the Delta region. Also, six of the poorest counties in America are located in the Ozark Mountain region north of the Arkansas River. Frankly, there is more justification for the program in the mountain region. End quote. My, how times have changed. Northwest Arkansas and the mountain region Faubus alluded to in that letter are certainly in better economic shape today than a half century ago. For a little more perspective, this year is just the 50th anniversary of Walmart, which has had a little something to do with the region's reversal of fortunes. Well, what will Northwest Arkansas look like over the next 50 years? There is a plan in place to start mapping that picture, as I found out when I sat down in Fayetteville recently with Mike Harvey, Chief Operating Officer of the influential Northwest Arkansas Council, a group of area business leaders working to push an economic agenda forward. All right, Mike, let's talk about business retention and expansion, those companies that are already here. Give me the elevator pitch for what you guys are doing.
Okay, so what we're doing is taking BRE, Business Retention Expansion, and trying to regionalize it. And the idea behind that is to work with our chamber partners in a real coordinated fashion, give them an online tool to reach out to existing businesses, survey and get their feedback, take their pulse on what's going on with their companies and with the business climate in this region. And we can do two things with that online tool. We can give them direct assistance, so there's a referral type of system involved in that. So if there's a need for training, if there's a need for logistical support or a stoplight or whatever it is they're having an issue with, we can immediately resolve that issue for them at the local level. The other piece of that is we're aggregating information over time as a part of that survey. And so as we're making 100 calls, 200 calls, 500 calls, we're able to really kind of see the trends and the issues of, is there an issue with this local service or this specific business climate, you know, legislative issue that we can kind of focus on at the council level to go to elected bodies at the local level, the state level, or the federal level and say, hey, this is an impediment to growth, to profitability, and if you fix this, we'll have more jobs. So it's a business climate tool as well.
Entrepreneurship, a key to future J.B. Hunt, Sam Walton's, John and Don Tyson's. What do you guys have going on in that realm?
You know, there's no real magic elixir to entrepreneurship. It takes, in my opinion, a few key elements, leadership being one of them, and I think leadership in this part of the world is certainly there. You know, the founders of the council, we call them, you know, the big three or big four, they're there for small businesses. They have made, you know, successful businesses, and they want to give back to the community, and so that's there. That's the first element. The other piece of that is how does the council lead, facilitate, support, promote an entrepreneurial ecosystem in this region? And that really encompasses, if you're an aspiring entrepreneur, how do we get you from idea to full-blown company? And so there's a process that a company goes through. There's an ecosystem there. So it's validate your idea, give you mentorship to bring that along, provide physical space for you in a, you know, an affordable fashion to nurture you and grow your company, and hopefully connect you with investors in Northwest Arkansas or abroad to fund your idea and your product and keep you here. So those four elements are really where our program is focused on, really kind of beefing up that ecosystem.
How about marketing? That's another critical component of what you guys are doing. What are you exactly marketing?
We're marketing the region, the place. And so there was no real regional brand for Northwest Arkansas. It was, you know, marketing done kind of a la carte. Each city was doing its own thing. There was no coordinated site selection assistance program. And so that's what we're working with the five cities to, you know, put together, you know, regional brand for Northwest Arkansas, understand which industries fit best here, and build a marketing program to go after those folks and bring them here.
You have a research study in process to assess the type of industries you'd like to attract and grow in Northwest Arkansas. Kind of tell me, what do you expect that study to show you?
Just to give you an idea, they're certainly looking around some of the traditional growth areas here. Our clusters, you know, we'd be foolish not to take advantage of food, logistics, and distribution, food, logistics, and retail to capitalize on. And the next generation of that, we're kind of weaving in our entrepreneurial programs with that, is how do you do IT and mobile applications to support those types of industries. And that's really where we feel like the next boom is for us.
That's Mike Harvey, Chief Operating Officer of the Northwest Arkansas Council.
Roby Brock is the publisher of TalkBusiness.net. Support for TalkBusiness.net on Ozarks at Large is provided by Mitchell Williams Law, providing strategic counsel on a variety of sophisticated legal matters since 1954. Mitchell Williams Law Firm combines decades of diverse professional experience to clients across the U.S. Today, the firm employs nearly 80 attorneys from four offices in Arkansas, Texas, and New York. Online at MitchellWilliamsLaw.com. And Bank of the Ozarks, more information available at BankOzarks.com. And Verizon, offering a wide selection of productivity-enhancing tablets for small business, including the Apple iPad. More information at a Verizon communications store near you or online at VZW.com/smallbusiness. And CEG Partners, using empirical data to better understand your customers' experiences and their loyalties. More information at CEGpartners.com.
Ahead on Ozarks, those little annoyances of warm weather in the Ozarks, ticks.
Fahrenheit, so that would vary depending on where you are. So I think if it's a warmer winter, for instance, I know this winter has been warmer, then ticks may start crawling earlier. So probably spring through summer.
The early arrival of ticks and what that does and doesn't mean for the outdoor activities you have scheduled this summer, ahead on Ozarks at Large.
On this week's Generic Blues Show, we recap and state a few changes made to the 2012 Eureka Springs Blues Weekend due to the untimely death of Michael Burks. That weekend is May 31st through June 3rd. Hear all about it on the Generic Blues Show, Friday nights at 9 on KUAF.
It's Wednesday, May 23rd, 2012. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
With us is Becca Martin-Brown. She is features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Okay, unless I'm mistaken, because my calendar is messed up, This is coming up on Memorial Day weekend.
Yeah, we're getting closer by the second.
I know. I hate that, too.
My favorite holiday of the year.
Why is it your favorite holiday?
Because it's... Never mind.
What?
You go ahead and explain. You get to explain that side.
It's a no-pressure holiday.
Okay.
You don't have to worry about presents for anyone. You don't have to worry about, a big ceremony or anything. B, it's the start of summer, which is my favorite time of year. C, I like the idea behind Memorial Day and thinking about people who've been close to you or made an impact on history. I just think it's a wonderful holiday.
Okay. Well, most people think it's a road trip.
Okay. Mm-hmm. That's fair.
And I've got three options for you.
Okay.
Bluegrass and barbecue is going on at the happiest place in the Midwest, Silver Dollar City. Mm-hmm. Music by people like Rhonda Vincent and The Rage, Ooh. The Grascals, Doyle Lawson and Quicksilver, and a ton of food. This continues through June 3rd at Silver Dollar City in Branson. Mm-hmm. The Oklahoma Renaissance Festival.
My friends and I are talking about going to this.
We're talking about going this weekend, too.
Because I've never actually been to the castle.
Oh, it's fun.
Okay. In Muskogee?
Mm-hmm. In Muskogee. This is the final weekend, includes the Memorial Day Monday. Tickets are $14.95 for adults, $12.95 for students, and $7.95 for kids 6 to 12. And you can find out more at okcastle.com. Or if you recognize the name Dale Chihuly, who does beautiful glass. Amazing, amazing stuff. And he has I saw a whole gallery of his work when I was in St. Petersburg for work a year or so ago. He has an exhibit this month at the Dallas Arboretum and Botanical Garden, which is a wonderful place in and of itself. It will be there through November 5th, and you can find out more at dallasarboretum.org.
Great, great tips. Thank you.
Becca Martin-Brown is features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers. If you've enjoyed the outdoors in the Ozarks already this year, there's a good chance you've encountered a tick. Ticks, usually a bigger problem in the warmest months of the year, came out earlier this year. Ozarks at Large's John Schlois recently talked with tick experts from the University of Arkansas and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention to find out what diseases ticks carry.
They can wait patiently for months with their arms outstretched, listening to the sounds or feeling the vibrations of their next meal. They don't fly or jump. They simply wait until something brushes by. They're ticks, and they'd like you to be their next meal. Chicks wait or quest until a suitable host approaches. Once on the host, they can take 10 minutes to 2 hours to find a suitable spot to cut into a person's skin and begin feeding on his blood. A tick inserts a feeding tube into the cut and may inject a small amount of its saliva, which could contain a pathogen, such as the one that causes Lyme disease or Rocky Mountain spotted fever. And ticks are out earlier this year than last year because of warmer temperatures. Megan Brett, a medical epidemiologist with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, talked with me about ticks and the diseases they spread.
It's important to know that ticks are active any time that ground temperatures are greater than 50 degrees Fahrenheit. So that would vary depending on where you are. So I think if it's a warmer winter, for instance, I know this winter has been warmer, then ticks may start crawling earlier. So probably spring through summer, up and through the fall as well. But again, it's temperature dependent.
Kelly Lofton, a professor and researcher at the University of Arkansas's entomology department, said ticks need a suitable environment to grow and breed.
A lot of times it depends on the habitat. If you have enough vegetation to have an area where you have a microclimate suitable for ticks, and basically what I'm saying, you've got enough grass or weeds to have an area of high humidity, which they need. That's important. Another thing that's real important is availability of hosts to feed on. So if you have those two together, you can definitely have an area with ticks.
Lofton said a tick can live for a year or two feeding on different hosts.
The engorged female lays eggs. After it's mated, lays eggs. Those eggs hatch into larval ticks, six legs, what we call sea ticks. Those ticks attach to host, the larval ticks, feed, drop off, molt to the next stage, which is a nymphal stage, and once they find that other host, they attach, feed, till they become replete or full of blood, drop off, molt to an adult tick. The adult tick attaches, feeds on us, and the female takes a tremendous amount of blood that she transfers, basically, or uses to make the egg mass. And what I've described is basically of a three-host tick, which are mostly what we are concerned with, are the three-host ticks. There are some ticks that may only have two hosts.
A tick might pick up a disease-causing pathogen from one host and then pass it on to another host during a different stage of its life.
That's where it's really important when we talk about a one, two, or three-host tick. What will happen, a tick will acquire a disease from one of those hosts, transmit it to another host. So there may be some amplification in the host, and when they feed, they transmit it through their feeding. There are a few cases where there can be transovarial transmission, which basically means that if a female adult acquired a disease, it can be transmitted to her offspring, which would be the larval ticks. But that's not real common. And generally, it's a small percentage of the offspring that do that.
The CDC recorded about 22,500 confirmed cases of Lyme disease in 2010. The last year data is available. That compares with almost 30,000 cases in 2009. During those years, no cases of the disease were confirmed in Arkansas. Here's Megan Brett with the CDC.
Lyme disease is predominantly found in the Northeast and the Upper Midwest. It's transmitted by the black-legged tick. This black-legged tick is found in the North and in the South. The thing that differs, though, is that the biting patterns of the ticks that are found in the North differ from those that are found in the South. Additionally, when ticks have been tested to look for the bacteria that causes Lyme disease, the rates of infection of these ticks are very low in the South compared with those that are found in the North, say in places like Connecticut. So that's why people in the South are less likely to encounter these ticks. And if they do, then the likelihood that they would be bitten by an infected tick is also much lower.
A disease that is found in the South is STARI, or the Southern Tick-Associated Rash Illness.
It presents as a rash, and it actually looks quite similar to Lyme disease. And so people can, it's very easy to confuse with Lyme disease because, in fact, it's more like a bullseye rash, which is one of the symptoms that you can see in early Lyme disease. The interesting thing about that is that's found more often in the South, and that's why it's called Southern Tick-Associated Rash Illness. It's actually transmitted by ticks that are common in Arkansas, so it's transmitted by the Lone Star tick. But Star Eye has not, unlike Lyme disease, Star Eye hasn't been linked to any sort of chronic or continuing symptoms.
Another disease that is transmitted by ticks common in Arkansas is Rocky Mountain Spotted Fever. The CDC listed 151 confirmed cases of the disease in 2009, the last year the data was available. They estimated that there were probably 1,662 other cases that went unconfirmed. Only one confirmed case was listed in Arkansas, but the group noted 183 probable other cases for the state. Fever, headaches, nausea, and a rash make up the symptoms of the disease. Not all people get the rash, which usually consists of small, flat, pink spots. Dr. Brett said this rash usually starts at the extremities and spreads to the trunk of a person. The CDC says the disease can be fatal if not treated within the first 8 days of symptoms. Other diseases spread by ticks in Arkansas include ehrlichiosis and anaplasmosis. Symptoms of ehrlichiosis and anaplasmosis include fever, headache, chills, and muscle pain. The CDC notes that a combination of symptoms varies greatly from person to person. Here again is Dr. Brett with the CDC.
So ehrlichiosis typically would it typically causes fever, and it can cause a rash in about 30% of patients, and it can be actually up to 60% in children. And the rash can either just be flat, or it can actually kind of form bumps, and it may appear before the onset of fever.
Both diseases can be fatal if not treated. The good news is that a tick usually needs to be attached for several hours to transmit a pathogen, anywhere from 24 to 36 hours. So avoiding ticks and then finding them quickly is paramount. Here's Dr. Lofton again with the university's entomology department.
Well, one of the first things to do, basically, and a lot of people do not want to do this, but if you wear light-colored clothing, you know, light pants, shirts, and even wear long sleeves, tuck your pant legs into your socks, you can see the ticks. That helps a lot, some protection there. Another thing that worked very well is a clothing-only repellent. It's for clothing only. Cannot be used on the skin. An example would be Repel Permanon, and it contains permethrin. You apply that to the clothes, let them dry, and then put your clothes on. That will help a tremendous amount. Now, there's some skin repellents containing DEET and Picardian. Those are a couple of the repellents that are to be used on skin. All that protection really, really does work well.
The CDC recommends removing a tick by using a pair of fine-tip tweezers. Grasp the tick as close to the skin surface as possible and pull upward with steady, even pressure. Don't twist or jerk the tick. Then clean the area with soap and water or rubbing alcohol. Lofted pointed out that encountering a tick in the wild is nothing to worry about.
I would hate for the fear of acquiring a tick-borne disease to prevent someone from enjoying the outdoors. That's where the personal protection comes into play because, I mean, there's a lot of enjoyment walking around in the woods or out enjoying nature, and we don't want to let them win.
For Ozarks at Large, I'm John Schlois.
The CDC hosts a wealth of information about ticks, the diseases they carry, and the symptoms of those diseases at their website, cdc.gov/ticks.
Now, from an outdoor nuisance to outdoor nirvana. Gardening can provide food for the table, but also quiet for the soul. Saturday, the 7th Annual Omni Center's Peace Gardens Tour will highlight 8 area gardens from 10 until 3. This week, Dick Bennett, the founder of the Omni Center, and Emily Cates, a past participant in the event, came to the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio to talk about this year's version of the tour. Dick Bennett says the Peace Gardens Tour is an appropriate fundraiser for the group.
Our organization has begun to emphasize ecology much more than we did when we started. We were more a peace and justice organization, but we're now a peace, justice, and raise your voice ecology organization, I suspect. And so now our gardens are thinking of beauty and now preserving species, providing habitat for the animals that are pressed in so many ways, including now weather, mm-hmm. and in general the climate. And so now we're all these different levels of activities, and I suspect there will be more to appear that we haven't thought of yet. Emily?
My garden has always been pesticide-free, and I believe most of the gardens on the tour are. It hasn't even occurred to me to ask people, but I'm just assuming here that the Omni Peace Gardeners are not into, you know, heavy chemicals, pesticides, things of that nature. A lot of them also are very into native plants and so on. And certainly, speaking for myself, since I've been on the tour, like I say, four different times, and gardening is a peacetime activity. And somebody told me recently that people who garden are less likely to take antidepressants. It's something that makes you feel good. It you are in touch with the earth, and it's a peaceful activity, and it makes you feel good. That's what I have to say about it. So that's one reason I do it, besides the fact mm-hmm. that I like having a yard that looks attractive. So
everyone does say it's therapeutic, mm-hmm. don't they? That beauty in the first place is therapeutic.
Yeah.
But the exercise and then the nutrition. So mm-hmm. there are many levels. It's personally beneficial, and increasingly we think of it as beneficial to the planet.
There's a wide variety of things that people can smell, see, and look at this year. Everything from yeah. bamboo to wishing ball garden.
Yeah, and Ann Reichert's wonderful garden out at Lake Sequoia, that's really more a series of sculptural installations incorporating living things. That was last year was her first time on the tour, and we're delighted she's part of it again. It's really a spectacular place. And there's also a wonderful garden this year that Nick and I have both visited, David and Cookie Parrish. It's called Parrish Peace Place, and it's on Cedar Hill Drive, just a little east of Fayetteville off of Highway 45. And it's three different garden areas named for, people and their family and other things. And just very nice. A lot of flowers, a lot of space.
Do you garden, Dick?
I do.
What is your favorite or a favorite thing to have in your garden?
I'll surprise you.
Okay.
Because I actually haven't gardened it. It's a poke. It's a native plant mm-hmm. that I have learned to like, despite the warnings from so many people who fear that it will poison you or upset your stomach or something, and perhaps it does. Mm-hmm. But I only have to boil it one time, or steam it even, mm-hmm. mildly steam it, and it's delicious to me. I like it better than spinach now.
Do you have a particular favorite that you like to have in your garden?
Well, I've got some very cool things. And one thing that's coming out now in my garden, which isn't on the tour this year, but I've got some hybridized daylilies that were given to me by Betty Grabby up in Springdale, who's a woman I garden for sometimes, and she is a daylily hybridizer. And they're different than the more common just sort of orange daylilies, which are very pretty, by the way. But these, some of them have several colors, or, you know, kind of one petal, one color, another. There's some that are kind of pink, some that are kind of purple, some that are more yellow. They're unusual and different, and that's something coming out in my garden now I especially enjoy. I also like the larkspur, which I've never planted. It comes up. It's an annual that reseeds itself, and I'm sure you've seen it. It's a tall, spindly plant with feathery leaves, and it's in purple and lavender and white and pink and various shades between all those things. And it's just gorgeous this year, not only in my garden, but I've seen it in a lot of mm-hmm. other places. So,
speaking of flowers, I have a large area of bell flower, I was told it was. And I think I must have gotten that from Carl Totemeyer several years ago before he died.
That's a thing about gardens that sometimes some of us don't think about, is that here's something that you got from Carl, who's well known in this area, and it keeps memories alive of people who've left us.
It does. Yeah. And we all gardeners are exchanging plants a lot. So that's another connection. You say, I got that from so-and-so.
Yeah. A sense of community.
Yes,
One of the plants I have, it's a shade plant, and it's very beautiful. It's a variegated Solomon seal, and it was given to me some years ago by Nancy Meyer, whose garden, although Nancy passed away a few years ago, her garden that she started continues to be on the tour with Marshall Carter and Marilyn Fincher. Continuing work in that garden that is called the Bluebirds of Peace Garden. Mm-hmm. And so it's, you know, sort of a memorial to Nancy, and I'm fortunate to have a plant that she gave me that always reminds me of her. So, yeah, plants can, they can be meaningful in that way.
The 7th Annual Omni Center Peace Gardens Tour is Saturday from 10 until 3. Tickets available at each garden. You can see descriptions about each participating garden and a map of the gardens online at omnicenter.org.
Support for KUAF comes from Walton Arts Center, announcing its 12th annual Art of Wine Festival running June 7th through the 9th. This event features a winemaker's dinner, brunch, two evenings of wine tasting, and classes including Wine Tasting 101 and the Sparkling Wine Extravaganza. Art of Wine Festival tickets and more information available at waltonartscenter.org or 443-5600.
And support for KUAF also comes from Westwood Gardens, offering a variety of Westwood-grown annuals, perennials, and hanging baskets. Four locations in Northwest Arkansas, 442-3500 or westwoodgardens.com.
Cory Booker turns stomachs at the White House. Arizona demands the president's birth certificate. Arkansas and Kentucky wrap up their primaries. Ron Paul supporters take over another state. And a court challenge to Senate filibuster rules. I'm Neil Conan. Political junkie Ken Rudin joins us. Plus, lessons from a reluctant couch surfer. Next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation beginning at 1, right after Ozarks at Large.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kelms. With me is our history doctor, Bill Smith. Welcome back.
Glad to be back.
Role of the Supreme Court became a center of political controversy earlier this year. Taking a look at the history behind the battle between the chief executive and the Supreme Court is our history doctor. Help me out here.
Well, when the media has some presentism, it's one thing. It's a little more disturbing when a person who has defined himself as a constitutional law scholar makes a statement like this. Ultimately, I'm confident that the Supreme Court will not take what would be an unprecedented, extraordinary step of overturning a law that was passed by a strong majority of a democratically elected Congress.
That's a very strong statement.
Yes, it is. And President Obama is marking his territory against what he sees as a Supreme Court that is not cooperating with the executive. It comes on the heels of 2 years ago when he made statements that drew the ire of the court itself during the State of the Union address. You know, in many ways, this is politics by other means. But the words from the president were strong and a little disconcerting because to say it is unprecedented for the court to review cases and overturn them is ignoring one of the fundamentals of our constitutional system. He's also falling in line with previous chief executives that have been frustrated with the court. They would be quick to say one party's activist judge is another party's scholarly thinker.
It depends on whether that court is agreeing with you at that time, I suppose.
Exactly. Now, the president's press secretary tried to clarify, saying that President Obama was using legal shorthand and that the president was not clearly understood by some people. I think I clearly understood the quote. When his own teachers at Harvard Law say that they think he may have misspoke, it will eventually lead the president to restate his position. He will then come back to saying that this would be the first time in decades to strike down legislation related to the economy. The quote again, "We have not seen a court overturn a law that was passed by Congress on economic issue like health care, as I think most people would consider commerce. A law like that has not been overturned since Lochner. So we're going back to the 30s, pre-New Deal."
Does that hold up, that statement?
Well, no. And once again, we're seeing the president be more like the media that we've talked in the past. First of all, within that walk back, the New Deal obviously was in the 1930s. Pre-New Deal is 1932. Frankly, there were significant parts of the New Deal that the court indeed did strike down during the early phases, including ones that touched with the Commerce Clause, and almost all were some kind of economic issue. For example, mortgage relief to farmers went down unanimously before the court in 1935, along with the National Industrial Recovery Act. Roosevelt had his own outburst like that, saying that the court was, quote, horse and buggy with its definition of interstate commerce.
That's pretty strong.
He lost the next year the Agricultural Adjustment Act, one of the original 100 days pieces of New Deal legislation, as that was invalidated by the court. Smaller cases since have been overturned that were attempts to extend the Commerce Clause, notably gun possession near schools and domestic violence. And the Interstate Commerce Clause each time was found to be not that broad. So in a political frustration, we have a fairly bad misstep.
So did President Roosevelt's frustration with all this, did this lead to his attempts to, as they say, pack the court?
Yes. So in a kind of comparison of frustrated chief executives, under the guise of helping the aging court members, Franklin Roosevelt exploited the ultimate constitutional loophole with a plan to appoint judges who would more than likely vote his way. For every Supreme Court justice over the age of 70, he would appoint an additional justice, up to six of them, as well as more lower court justices to help the efficiency of the Supreme Court. His argument being, these gentlemen are old, mm-hmm. and they haven't retired, and there's no way to make them retire, but we can certainly help them pick up the pace of their work by giving them a younger justice to work with.
And you know what? I'd be happy to be the president that appoints them.
Exactly. I'm only helping. Sounds a lot like the frustration that Roosevelt was feeling initially was that he had Social Security, passed in 35, headed likely to Supreme Court review in 37 or 38, and with his overwhelming election in 37, he decided to take the court on directly, instructing his Attorney General Homer Cummings to come up with this idea to create a court majority. They first thought about amending the Constitution and then sort of come to the realization in that loophole I mentioned. The loophole in the Constitution on the Supreme Court is that there's no definition of how many Supreme Court justices should be there.
Yeah, you can have.
So he could say, I want 15. Mm-hmm. And that's what he was basically saying. I'm going to have 15 Supreme Court justices. I'll keep the nine that I had and port, well, you know, we'll just add a few more. FDR took to the radio to explain why he wanted to do this. Reading the transcript from this little fireside chat, it's a little chilling today. Instead of speaking of checks and balances, the federal government, in FDR's definition, was a three-horse team lashed to do the people's work.
To do it together, lockstep?
Exactly, and this is how he said it. Two of the horses, the Congress and the executive, are pulling in unison today. The third is not. So Obama and FDR share that while they both would agree in their talks that Marbury versus Madison was legitimate law of the land, that the Supreme Court does have the right to review legislation, they both, in their respective times, will accuse the court of being activist, to use our present term, mm-hmm. or, as FDR said it, acting not as a judicial body, but as a policymaking body. How many Republican senators have you heard say that same thing?
You bet.
This is the quote, though, in the fireside chat that really kind of gives you the sense of both how far FDR has gone and how far he's willing to go. We have, therefore, reached a point as a nation where we must take action to save the Constitution from the court and the court from itself. We must find a way to take an appeal from the Supreme Court to the Constitution itself. We want a Supreme Court which will do justice under the Constitution and not over it.
Did he have success?
No, he did not, because that line and several others within the fireside chat really scared many members of Congress, both sides of the party. Mm-hmm. This will fail as legislation because both parties will come together. Remember, the Republicans are at epic lows in both houses. Yet this is a bill that when it is introduced, FDR cannot get the House to put forward. He has to arm twist senators to get it moving. So it's headed toward defeat. Yet at the same time, it worked. Journalists look back today on a sudden change in Justice Owen Roberts, who began to vote to uphold New Deal plans after the proposal became known. He is called the switch in time that saved nine. Mm-hmm. So 5-4 votes went from going against Roosevelt to going for Roosevelt. And the Judiciary Reorganization Bill of 37 went down to defeat. Even his own vice president, John Nance, literally held his nose in the Senate and gestured his thumb down when asked about this bill.
I want to ask you a little bit more about key cases here, but this explains why someone who may feel on one side when the California Supreme Court strikes down Prop 9, say you champion that decision because you think, yes, they struck something down unconstitutional, or you're angry because it was something that was properly elected, then we'll take the exact opposite stance on what they hope the Supreme Court does with the health care.
Exactly. You know, the key cases as you're looking back over time are that 1803 landmark case, Marbury versus Madison, which established the ability of the court to review. Our current attorney general has made it very clear that in his mind that is beyond dispute. But it wouldn't be long after 1803 that another president, Andrew Jackson, would disagree with the court. And when it ruled in Worcester versus Georgia, the court laid the groundwork for today's tribal nations, but at the same time infuriated Jackson, who proclaimed that the Supreme Court Justice, John Marshall, has made his decision. Let him go enforce it.
Well, but that's a case that's over 200 years old. Does that?
There are, but you sort of danced around it. But if you look in just our recent past, Brown versus Board of Education, 1957, mm-hmm. is overturning the actions of elected mm-hmm. officials. Roe v. Wade, 1973, overturning the decisions of elected officials. So one has to be careful when using President Obama's phrase of overturning a law that was passed by a strong majority of the democratically elected Congresses. You know, these were state cases, so that you say Congress is plural. But, you know, I think many of the same folks that would be concerned about today's Supreme Court would certainly have qualms about Roe v. Wade or Brown versus Board going against and being upheld mm-hmm. because, well, after all, it was strong majorities of these democratically elected houses, legislatures, Congresses that established the laws on abortion and segregation.
Right. Well, until our conversations are declared unconstitutional,
we're history.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday. It's the 23rd of May, 2012. It's the birthday of the poet Jane Kenyon, born Ann Arbor, 1947. She married her professor at the University of Michigan, the poet Donald Hall, and went to live in New Hampshire on his ancestral farm. Published only 4 books of poetry before she died from leukemia at the age of 47. Donald Hall wrote of their life together, "We got up early in the morning. I brought Jane coffee in bed. She walked the dog, then climbed the stairs to work at her desk on her poems. We had lunch. We lay down together. We rose and worked at other things. I read aloud to Jane. We played scoreless ping pong. We read the mail. We worked again. We ate supper, talked, read books, sitting across from each other in the living room, and went to sleep. If we were lucky, the phone didn't ring all day." It's the birthday of Margaret Wise Brown, born Brooklyn, 1910. She was a socialite. She was tall. She had blonde hair, bright green eyes. Never had children herself, but she was a teacher in a progressive school, the Bank Street Experimental School in New York. And she wrote 2 children's classics, The Runaway Bunny and Goodnight Moon. Died suddenly at the age of 42 on a book tour in Europe, stricken with appendicitis, had an emergency appendectomy, seemed to be recovering, decided to show her doctor how good she felt, so she kicked up her leg in a can-can, which caused an embolism, and she died instantly. And it's the birthday of the novelist Ursula Hege, born Dusseldorf, Germany, 1946. Emigrated to this country, she was embarrassed to tell people that she was German. Wrote 2 novels set in the United States, and then in 1990 wrote Floating in My Mother's Palm, set in the fictional town of Bergdorf, Germany, and then another, Stones from the River, about a woman who is a dwarf, an outsider in the village, and who watches the Nazis come to power in Germany and her fellow townspeople turn against their Jewish neighbors. Here's a poem for today by Jane Kenyon entitled Church Fair. Who knows what I might find on tables under the maple trees? Perhaps a saucer in Aunt Lois's china pattern to replace the one I broke the summer I was 13 and visiting for a week. Never in all these years have I thought of it without a warm surge of embarrassment. I'll go through the closets and cupboards to find things for the auction. I'll bake a peach pie for the food table and rolls for the supper, Grandma Kenyon's recipe, which came down to me along with her legs and her brooding disposition. Mrs. Kenyon, the doctor used to tell her, you are simply killing yourself with work. This she repeated often with keen satisfaction. She lived to be 103, surviving all her children, including the one so sickly at birth that she had to carry him everywhere on a pillow for the first 4 months. Father suffered from a weak chest, bronchitis, pneumonia, and pleurisy, and early on, books and music became his joy. Surely, these clothes are from another life, not my own. I'll drop them off on the way to town. I'm getting the peaches today, so they'll be ripe by Saturday. Church Fair by Jane Kenyon from Let Evening Come, published by Gray Wolf Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, celebrating 100 years of discovering great poets and printing their verse. Back issues and subscriptions available at poetryfoundation.org. And by Barnes & Noble, maker of Nook, simple touch with glow light, designed for reading with the lights on or off, available at Barnes & Noble stores or Nook. com. Edited by Noah Smith. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Support for KUAF comes from the Malco Theater's Kids Summer Film Fest, beginning June 5th and continuing through August 1st, each Tuesday and Wednesday morning at 10 a.m. Seating limited, so early arrival recommended. The Malco Kids Summer Film Fest schedule and more information available, malco.com. And KUAF is proud to co-sponsor Walton Arts Center's Artisphere, Arkansas's Arts and Nature Festival, with the Chamber Music Series. From June 14th through the 21st, classical trios, quartets, and quintets will perform at various locations, including Thorn Crown Chapel in Eureka Springs, Cooper Chapel in Bella Vista, and St. Paul's Church in Fayetteville. More information at artisphearfestival.org.
KUAF and Pipeline Productions are offering you the chance to win two festival passes to the 2012 Wakarusa Music Festival at Mulberry Mountain, May 31st through June 3rd. Artists include the Abbott Brothers, Pretty Lights, Edward Sharp, and more. The drawing is this Friday during the noon edition of Ozarks at Large. Registration and more information are available online at KUAF.com. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Rogers, Fort Smith, Seligman, Missouri.
Seligman, Missouri.
Yep.
What's that?
Why not?
Why not? I've been to Seligman, Missouri.
Mm-hmm.
Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
Quickly, you went to Alley 38, which
is a
production that's on the streets and alleys of Fayetteville. How was it?
I really, really enjoyed the second half of it. I really liked that everything was outdoors. It was very cool having the, I don't know, downtown Fayetteville being your backdrop instead of just a traditional stage. It's kind of hard to explain, except I'd say go, but make sure you have comfortable shoes.
Okay. Good advice. Thanks, Antoinette.
Thanks, Kyle.